welcome to the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, Arsene Kashkashian, the head buyer at the Boulder Bookstore, is my co-host and a very special guest today. And in fact, this is a special edition because we had to squeeze this author in. We have a chock-a-block book club this year, but there was no way we were going to pass up the opportunity to have a returning author come in. I'm going to let you introduce her, Arsene.
Well, we have Alexandra Fuller, and she's here with a memoir, Travel Light, Move Fast. She was last here for her novel, Quiet Until the Thaw. And so memoirs is what she's really been known for over her career, and so it's a lot of fun to be able to get her in here and talk about the memoir.
Alexandra, it's great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're so excited. I mean, the book is just out this week.
Yes.
And I believe this is the first interview
yes.
of the book. And, you know, this is a heavy book. It's a wonderful read. It's heavy in terms of the subject matter, which we're going to get into. And so we're very much appreciative of you coming here to KGNU. Now, this Travel Light, Move Fast, it's really, I found it a love story to your dad, who died at the beginning of the book, and you lay out, you know, what happened. And of all places, I mean, your previous memoirs have chronicled the various different adventures in all parts of southern African countries of your parents moving around. But for some reason, your father was in Budapest, and that's where he died. First of all, why was he and your mom in Budapest?
Well, I mean, it seems to me so coherent that he would choose a country we could, but I'd never even thought of. I mean, I never thought of going to Hungary. As I was flying on the plane to Budapest to meet him in the ICU there, I was thinking, wait, wasn't Istanbul? Wasn't, you know, just that kind of, that crazy feeling you have, I think, when you get the news that someone's fatally ill. And they had gone to Budapest because it was, someone had told them it was the poor man's Paris. And there is this way in which, and this is really in so many ways what the book's about, that my father sort of honed himself down to the essence of who he was. And part of that essence was living this sort of outrageously large life on really a very small budget financially, but a massive budget emotionally. And with this sort of real attachment to the richness of life, not to the affluence of life. When I got a phone call, it wasn't from mum, it was from friends saying your father's really ill and we've taken him to the ICU in Budapest and he has pneumonia. I knew immediately that this wasn't something he was going to recover from because I knew my father well and I knew that whatever he does, he did 110%, including if he got pneumonia, it was probably, he was going to, you know, sort of put that into full gear. And he, watching him die was such a wonderful lesson, such a gift, because he suffered so magnificently, so, his ego was so dissolved in suffering, which is what suffering's for. But you don't know that till you see it. You don't know how painful it is until you have to do it. But watching him, I thought, well, at least I have a template for what suffering well looks like. And, you know, your own death is saying goodbye to everything you love. And I think at the same time, if you do death well, and the English used to say this, well, was it a good death? By which they meant, did you die with some sort of grace and dignity? And I think we've really lost sight of that. You know, I think my father really had a good death in that he kept his own small death in perspective. And that was part of the lesson, sitting vigil as he was dying, was him reminding me how lucky he had been, even on his deathbed.
And he had been lucky. I mean, he'd escaped death many times. You had lived in a war zone when you were growing up in what was then Rhodesia. And he had come very close to death in a very violent way many times. And so you said when you got the call that he had pneumonia, you knew that was the end. I mean, what about all the previous times? Was there ever, this is the end for Dad, and he pulled through?
I think there's this weird way when you grow up like that, that you sort of sense that, well, look, if malaria didn't get him and the war didn't get him and all these big, big magnificent things get him, it was, after all, the mundane, ordinary, you know, gift really of pneumonia that took him. And he always said, oh, a good dose of malaria, you know, that should be the end of me. He didn't want to outstay his welcome. He really had, I think, a very English and Southern African, old English, I should say. I don't think it exists anymore, but a sort of Southern African attitude towards life had developed, in which, you know, fuel was expensive, but life wasn't, I've always said. You know, if my sister and I ever claimed to be deadly ill on the farm, my dad would say, well, how sick? But, you know, is it really worth the fuel to town if you're going to croak anyway? And he carried that attitude forward. There was something joyous about it. There was something. He didn't take himself too seriously, and yet he took the love of life so seriously. And I think that in a time when, you know, we are, all of us collectively, in grief over a changing planet, over our internal violence, over our sort of collective political deaths, many of them, the death of hope, really, in a lot of ways, to watch someone, an example of what it looks like to refuse to sort of give in to the dark. There isn't a better gift you can give your child.
You know, one of the passages that really struck me was you're walking from the hotel to the hospital and you're passing through all these refugees who've come to Hungary and kind of their collective grief, and you're dealing with your personal grief. And, you know, what's left with you from those impressions you had just of Hungary? You were there in such a kind of a wild moment to be there. And to see that what we see on the news, you were walking the streets through it, but to your own grief.
Right. And I think that what it did, and grief, I think, is supposed to do this. I think grief is supposed to almost immediately, it is two things. It's both the most, early grief is the most narcissistic thing that you can encounter. Everything feels fresh and new. It's like you're childlike again. But I think it collects you to the collective humanity, the way birth does, that surge of joy one feels at birth, that nothing can, that all births, you know, you just sort of feel this love for all of life. And the way, the same is true, I think, for grief, that suddenly you're able to feel other people's individual grief, not as a photograph that you've seen at some distance, but as this very personal thing that each person has to carry. I mean, none of us are going to escape it. And that how well one dissolves one's ego is how well one is going to deal with grief. And that was something my father so well understood, that one should always take your personal grief in light of the bigger collective grief that is always around you. You know, that happened to be going on in Budapest while he was dying, but that happened in countries around Southern Africa our entire lives. When we weren't at war ourselves and had moved up to Zambia, there had been civil conflict and war in every country surrounding Zambia at some point or other, except for Malawi. And so it was, I think, a part of our training, really, to know, no, things can get worse and will get worse and do get worse and are worse for people, and not to sort of privilege your own sort of sense of being above everybody else's. But I think that that's a difficult lesson.
So having turned so much of your experience and your family's experience into memoirs and writing so beautifully about it over the years, when you're in such an intense situation like that, is part of your head processing a memoir at all? Or are you just in the moment? Because there's such a passage in the book where your dad says in the hospital, he says, did I do this to get into one of your awful books? And does that feel when he says something like that, well, that's coming out of nowhere because I'm not there at all right now? Or is there part of your brain really observing, really making connections that you're later going to flesh out?
I think that that is the difference that separates an artist from a non-artist, is artists, writers, you know, we're seers. We're supposed to be looking at things with an eye to making art from it. And it is a strange gift to have, because it gives you a protective distancing from whatever it is that's going on. Of course, I'm already putting it into words. I mean, my father and I sort of joked about it. It didn't shock me at all, but I couldn't imagine in that moment the distance that I would need between his death and my writing about it, or how I would even talk about it. I mean, it's a few years before the insistence of that story happened. But the way that it evolved for me, really, I think his death first shocked me into that state of grievance that I think many of us don't take the time to work through, which is that, I mean, you become a grievance in search of a narrative. Suddenly everything in your life is a horror story. And we don't take out time to grieve in this culture very well. We don't have ritual for it. We don't have shared sort of contractual grieving. In Zambia, where I come from, there's something called Mzimu, which is, it's an understood that when someone dies, the people close to you roll on the ground in agony at your distress, because it's understood that to break the attachment between two people who love each other very much is so difficult. It takes a kind of physical thrashing on the earth. You howl and scream for the people grieving, because it's understood this is not something that should be done alone. And, you know, I deeply and desperately missed that. In the process of grieving, but in a way, writing about it is my personal Mzimu. It's my way to sort of roll on the ground, to struggle through that close physical attachment, to reach the metaphysical attachment.
Do you feel a sense of coping then with grief because you're able to write about it or write through it? I mean, is that, I don't even want to say cathartic, but is it in any way healing to be able to have the gift, really, of the words? Because so many people, because we don't talk about death and we don't talk about bereavement or we don't talk about grief, many people don't even have the vocabulary. I mean, we talk about this a lot, that if somebody meets somebody who's lost someone, we don't even know how to offer our condolences because we're so uptight about this as a subject matter. The fact that you are a writer and you have access to words, was that in any way a healing process for you?
It has to have been. And I'm thank you for your hesitancy, because it's such brutal work. And yes, of course, there's times in the process of writing it. I started to write a book about the death of my father, and then my son died. So the backstory of this book is that it was so much written. I mean, I'd probably written about a third of the book when my son died. And then that shifted everything. I mean, that really did make it this instruction for myself. How do I survive the worst thing that can happen to a person? Of course, not the worst thing that can happen to a person, but it certainly feels that way, that this felt like it happened to me, at me. And so much of writing about my father's death was this way of sort of buoying me through. It's been a year, and it's been 13 months, really, since my son died. And my father had lost three children, and then his own life, and, you know, which one relinquishes everything. And he had become such a good loser, so good at what it meant to lose. And so for me, writing about it really became an exploration of, well, we're all getting there. We're all reluctantly going to, quote unquote, lose. This is, none of this is stuff we can hang on to. Whatever we're clinging on to is, and we know this, it's not the essence of ourselves. The essence of ourselves is some pared down thing. It is a mystery. But to have lost both, I mean, to lose your father is to lose your past, and to lose your son is to lose your future. And so to be left in this very stark present is what writing the book did to me, where, you know, where I really was just coping on every day, and what it takes every day to get up and do the work of your life and not give up and follow your son. I mean, the impulse to follow, I think, the dead is very strong. And I would say that above all, the example of the people amongst whom I was raised gave me what it took to keep going and to write this. That is my farming. Dad was a farmer, and we would often talk about writing and as of farming, because I said it's so similar. You know, you have to sort of prepare your fields, which is that cultivation of mind and soul. And then you plant your seeds, which are these little black words, and then it grows into a crop that will either be something that you can reap or not. I mean, worms can get in there till the very end. But the honest graft of getting up and doing your work put me in step with most of the rest of humanity, women who lose their children and who don't have, and who must, you know, get up and keep working, get up and keep planting fields. Not only that, but to have the privilege to be free and grieving. I couldn't help thinking about mothers who had lost their children and either party were incarcerated, or, you know, women who'd lost their children to police brutality, who'd lost their children to war, who'd lost their children crossing the border, and lost their children in the sort of great psychic violence that is humanity. So to have lost two very important men, but both of them peacefully, one at the beginning of his life and one at the end, I mean, it was very instructive. And to put it all on the page, it was a cathartic's the wrong word, but it was a great, didn't heal. It gave me the sort of spine, I suppose, to carry on. One is supposed to. We're built to grieve.
We're speaking with Alexandra Fuller today on KGNU, the Radio Book Club. Her latest book, Travel Light, Move Fast, and it is a memoir. And as we've heard, it's really about the two losses. And the bulk of the book really is about your dad. Mm. And then the very last chapter, you write that your son had died. And I didn't see that coming. And Arsene had texted me to say, have
you
finished it?
Did you read the end
yet? Yeah. And I have to say, I had to sit and just sit with that for such a long time. Was there ever a point where you thought, okay, now this book has now got to be about my son? Because you really just brought it in at the very, very end.
Well, no, because it's the, you know, you know, I knew that this book needed to be about my father because there was certainly not enough room between my son dying and me doing whatever work needs to be done to get through that. I was still really writing, I think, from a place of, you know, constantly evolving shock and instructing myself as I went on how to do this grief properly. What I see in our culture, what I'm seeing in our culture, what I'm seeing increasingly over the last 3 years, and I don't see an end to it, is a nation who has not grieved. And as soon as I was in so much grief for so long, I recognized, we're a nation stuck in denial, in anger, in bargaining. I mean, what more can this sort of ridiculous consumerism in the face of a shrinking planet be but bargaining? Depression. I mean, we're anxious, and very few of us have reached a place of acceptance. And I think that, you know, writing this as part of the process of grief means that you will, one will end up, I will end up at a place of acceptance, but that comes and goes from view.
You know, the book, the way, you know, there's a lot of heavy things in the book, but the book has a light touch, you know, to some extent.
It's hysterically funny.
Yes. And you talk about, you know, some of the stories with your mother, right, and your father and the way that their relationship worked over time. And I was wondering if you could talk about some of that. They were such different people, but in
do
some ways...
Do you mean
ways,
from each other or yeah, from the rest of humanity? Or
maybe
both?
Maybe both. But that they somehow, they were like, they balanced each other. I thought it was like a fulcrum or something. Like your mother wanted to be settled and was very deliberate, and your dad was impulsive and had to be on the move, and yet it somehow worked. And now that you can kind of look back on it from, you know, at this point in your life, what do you think about that relationship, and what instruction can you almost take from how they balanced each other?
I mean, I think that there is balance, and then I think there's codependency, and I think they can look shockingly similar. And I think that my parents had a mix of it. They didn't have the language for it. They never would have sort of sat there and had a discussion about their codependency or their relationship or any of the sort of boring, you know, psychological graft I seem to do on myself, which I think some of that's a function of being a writer, because one has to know oneself before you can know anything worth putting on the page. But what I noticed, I think, was immediately after Dad's death, it was as if a whole person had been cut in half. You know, after over 50 years together, there's this way in which they had melded as one. And that part of what I think worked in their relationship was that they didn't discuss their tragedies. They didn't really talk about, they never talked about the deaths of their children. They didn't grieve together. They really got on with their lives quite separately and independently of one another, fiercely guarding that, I think, from one another and from the world, and fiercely guarding it for each other. And that was the nature of their relationship. I don't think that it's something that I would emulate, because I have a much more, I'm much more interested in how, you know, relationships grow you as an individual, not how they sort of protect you as an individual. Mm-hmm. But theirs really was a fortress, I think. And they were able to behave incredibly badly within that fortress and have a lot of fun and be very wild and always sort of know where the other person's game was. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a real... They didn't use terms of endearment very often, but there was a real affection that surprised even my mother.
Well, I was struck by how you said let me get the wording right here, that they always had something larger to focus on, and somehow that helped bond them together. Or it wasn't all about, like you said, trying to talk about the relationship and trying to figure out every detail of the relationship. I mean, you know, they had snakes coming in the house. They had, you know, whatever else going on. They had a war that they're trying to farm through. They, you know, and I thought that was interesting because I feel a lot of people now, and maybe this has always been the case, but can be very focused inward. And by them being focused outward, they're able to have like a 50-year marriage. I mean, most people can't do that and don't have some of the issues that they had, right?
Well, okay. So this is something that I think about a lot, because I think that there is a fine line between sort of, you know, doing some introspection and then just completely barging ahead with this quite sort of, you know, in this rather heedless way that they had. On the other hand, there's a real gift to the way, partly because of where they live, partly because of who they were. They just didn't privilege their own suffering. They didn't privilege their own point of view. They didn't privilege their own sort of story in any way, because the story was always bigger than them. I mean, it's very hard to be bigger than the story of something as charismatic as even 100 acres in the middle Zambezi Valley. I mean, I just went back to the farm to sort of say a farewell to it, and there were elephants running through the bananas every day. And so it's very hard to sort of sit there and navel gaze in the face of what you need to do to keep elephants out of your bananas. And yet at the same time, I think there's this way that you learn about yourself. You learn where your courage is. You learn where your limits are. You learn what you can endure. And it makes of you, I think, a more robust person. So you're not, you know, I think the one gift that they really had in relationship, because of living such a larger life, was they weren't injured all the time by one another. There were too many actual other injuries coming at them.
Yeah, physical.
Mental, emotional, right. All of it. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have you read a passage, Arson. You've selected a passage for Alexandra.
Yeah, so the book is beautifully written, and there is some light touches to it. And this passage is really kind of, your father is still alive at this passage, but he's really struggling, and it's pretty obvious that he's not going to survive. So I was just hoping you could read this.
Mum and I sat on either side of the bed and watched Dad for a while, the effort he was making. "Oh, Bobo," Mum whispered. "It's the final stretch, isn't it?" "I think so," I whispered. Time was suddenly revealed to be utterly surreal and impossibly demanding reality. There's no turning back the clock. There's no way to shove the minutes behind you or to drag out an end. Everything is always starting and ending all the time without cease. It was only the stories we told that gave time the impression of shape or meaning. Or prospect. "Nearly home," Dad always said once we could see the little bridge with the crumpled guardrails a dozen miles west of the border between Zambia and Zimbabwe. The bridge was usually choked with goats. Also, it had taken several structural hits, 18-wheelers trying to make the border before dark. Crossing that little bridge was a reminder of the impermanence of everything. But nearly home meant if the little bridge collapsed, or if the car broke down, or if we hit a goat and had to begin negotiating compensation with the goat's many sudden owners, or if the road was washed away in a flash flood, we'd be able to walk from here. Nearly home meant you were among your people, you were understood, your passage was assured, and your word was good. By Dad's standards, nearly home meant you were safe.
With Alexandra Fuller reading from Travel Light, Move Fast here at KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins.
So, well, let's talk about Africa a little bit. You're probably one of the writers that people in America read the most about Africa, to really get some idea of it. And in the book, Your mother talks a lot about Paul Thoreau. And I wonder where you see yourself in this span of people writing about Africa kind of for an American or Western audience. And mm-hmm. how does that affect your work? And do you read Paul Thoreau ever? You know, like, you know, who else do you ever read any of those other types of things?
I was so informed by Southern African writers. And for me, this shock of joy when I discovered that there had been this whole cadre of writers that the Rhodesian Literary Bureau had seen fit to keep from us. Namely, of course, black writers. I mean, because if you're an oppressive white supremacist nation, which Rhodesia was, the last thing you want to do is introduce intelligent, thoughtful, poetic, brilliant black writers, which would make you think about everything twice. And so it really wasn't until I was in my mid to late teens that I got introduced to Dambadza Marachera and, you know, Tsitsi Dumaringaba and even Chinua Achebe, who's the godfather of, you know, if we're going to talk about the whole continent of African, black African writers, he came out of the 60s. And I think that when I first read, I suppose Chinua Achebe, honestly, when I first read that, I thought, this is the literature I've been looking for my whole life, because the white experience of Africa tended to be so othering and so, it just had so much distance, and seemed to be lacking love. Not all of it, but a lot of it.
Well, your mother seems to celebrate when Thoreau has a miserable time. I mean, that's part of the book, right?
Yes.
I can't remember which book of his, but
it was his last book, the Going to Angola, finished him, according
right. to me. Yeah, he hated it, but she delights in that, right? Which is much, much different than how you're looking at you know, you're coming from there. He's a traveler.
Right. So well, and she would love me to sort of, I mean, so this is funny. I mean, there's this trope through the whole book of my mother sort of trying to push memoirs on me that other white settlers have written that are much nicer than my books, and sort of, you know, do a good job of glossing over the racism and all the violence and all the really uncomfortable stuff which I throw in there. My mother says, very startling point of view that you have. And yet it, you know, for me, I think that's really was the challenge. I think that all writers need to court eviction from their tribe. Otherwise, you're not doing your job. It's very easy to say, but to do it is brutal. And when you meet a writer and they have court eviction from their tribe, in fact, they've been evicted, you can tell. They have a certain liberation, but it is hard won. It's not comfortable. There's no, you know, sense that you can... there's no distancing. And I think that for me, there's something a little bit, I actually have had an email correspondence with Paul Theroux, which sort of thrilled me a bit, but for him, it's an adventure. For me, it's a life. And there is somewhere I've written, not in this book, that the way that you see a country changes considerably depending on whether or not you have a passport from that country or from somewhere else. Like, are you stuck there? Or are you free to leave at any time? Do you have an air ticket out? Because if you have a US passport and a ticket back to New York or wherever, your attitude about any place is going to feel different. You know it's temporary. But if you're a permanent resident, of course that changes everything. And it's one of the most common questions I get about my parents. Why didn't they leave? It's very difficult for Westerners, white Westerners, to talk about white settlers. I mean, I could just as easily ask any white American that question. Well, why don't you? I mean, why would you consider leaving after five generations? It's this way in which, you know, my parents feel very ingrained as Southern Africans. I think as a writer, you're already a bit of a traveler. You're a voyeur. You're always somewhat distanced. So I think, you know, from the beginning, everything for me, I was seeing it. I didn't know it. I didn't know at the time I was seeing everything through the lens of a writer. But since my point of view hasn't shifted as I've aged, all I can see now is that, oh, I was always destined to do this. This was, you know, the accusations of being noisy and asking too many questions and all those things. It turns out it was heading somewhere.
You described your parents as not being navel gazers by any stretch at all and really having an outward, you know, attitude. Do you think a lot of that was because they were white settlers? They were white supremacists, essentially, in a white supremacist society, that if you sat around and you think about this in any sort of introspective way, you realise the horror of what you're not just living through, but promoting.
And participating in. And I think we're there here in the US as white settlers, where we are avoiding digging into the narrative of our history. I'm a great irritant to people who I'd like to point out that there is something about being a white settler that is its own culture. You know, that we in this country have done a very good job of white settlers, of making white settler narrative the dominant narrative. So it seems to be the air that we breathe, rather than understanding, we're part of we're a blip in a long historical narrative in which being a white settler for a moment was quote unquote the norm. And one didn't have to examine, your history or how you got there. And I think this has a lot to do both there in Southern Africa and here with a sort of neurosis in white settler community, anxiety, opioid epidemic, where we have not properly grieved the means by which we arrived here, you know, the violence with which we've arrived here. And the insistence on sort of going forward is similar both in the States and, in my parents' moral narrative. You always go forward, you always look forward, because the horror of looking back means you might need to stop and sort of take responsibility, offer restitution, sit quietly in what it means to be white settler, just as African Americans have to sit with what it means to be African American daily. I mean, they don't get to avoid that question. So yes, I think so.
Well, your previous book, Quiet Until the Thaw, I mean, that was a novel, but it was very much focusing on Native Americans, written from the perspective of Native Americans. What reaction did you get to that? Because we got to talk to you when that book first came out, but in the aftermath of that, because one of the questions we asked you was, you're a white woman from a country that is a white supremacist country, was based on that, and to come here to write from the perspective of Native Americans, why and how and what reaction have you gotten?
Well, I don't really have social media. My 13-year-old daughter's in charge of my Instagram account, which is fabulous and very effective. But I don't really sort of read the feedback of the world. I mean, you need to come up to me and have a discussion, which I love. That I've made it so that if you want to discuss something, it's going to be a face-to-face discussion. But from what I could tell, there was an appropriate reaction. There were Indigenous Americans who were offended by the book and felt that I had no right to write it. I think that's a very valuable and a point of view, and I think it's worth listening to. I think it is worthy. I think it is possible the novel shouldn't have been written by me. I think that, I also heard from white settler Americans who said they had no idea, and in a way that seemed, they had no idea sort of that there was still such an alive and lively Indigenous culture and community in America. But not only that, there was an Indigenous community, I'm really thinking of the Lakota here on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, who are in active opposition to white supremacy. Once I started to see that, I could not, disconnect the white supremacy of Rhodesia and the white supremacy of the U.S. And some of the reaction has been, but you can't equate the two. And to which my response is, well, I can, and I do, and I have.
Well, you got conversation going. And what I liked very much about Quiet Until the Thaw was that the violence against that community continues. It's like everybody likes to think this is three generations ago. Well, everything was settled. As bad, as horrible as it was, it ended in 1900. And through that novel, and you can read other works too, obviously, but to see that, there's still violence and it might be happening in different ways than the cavalry riding in, but there's still violence against that community.
And, you know, the crazy thing is, and I don't know if I would have spoken about it then, but I wrote Quiet Until the Thorn Reaction to My Father's Death. I wrote it, it was much like this book in a way. I was writing it when he died. But I finished it with his death so heavy and with me. And so much of Quiet Until the Thaw was his insistence on our understanding that as white settlers, we had sort of profoundly screwed up by not paying attention to the indigenous communities around us, which were various and various. I mean, there was predominantly Mashona when I was growing up, but there was also Ndebele and you know, the Tonga, Chewa, I mean, very various different cultural Bemba influences growing up. But that to have lost that was to have amputated ourselves and made ourselves smaller and less resilient and smaller people. And that was part of his gift because he really came out to Africa as sort of the white settler from Britain and, you know, starting with Kenya and going to Rhodesia. And I think left the planet a really humble man, which didn't mean a small man. I mean, he still embraced this largeness of life, but he had really reduced the need for himself to be, I mean, be anything really, be a label of anything. And I think that is something that he learned living so extensively for most of his life among indigenous Southern Africans.
We're speaking with Alexandra Fuller today here at the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KG and you and the Boulder Bookstore. Her latest book, just out this week, it's a memoir, Travel Light, Move Fast, really about the death of your father. But then the very last chapter, of course, you talk about the death of your son. But you also talk about the loss and the shattering, really, of the family, which happens so often when somebody dies, whether it's the father or the mother, somebody who's almost a linchpin for the family. A whole family can shatter, even the closest of families, never mind the family that you grew up in that had so many layers of trauma. And you talk about the grief then of dealing with the loss of the relationship with your sister and then the loss of a romantic relationship as well. I mean, trauma upon trauma upon trauma and grief upon grief. You know, so this will be such a familiar story to so many people because this happens so frequently. But a year or so later, you know, have any of those relationships started to reform in any way?
Well, the relationship that between my family and I, the dissolution after my father's death, happened reasonably soon after he died and quite sort of catastrophically. And then there is that gradual, it's almost like being in a slow accident. You can see it coming. It seems like this must be something you can stop, but you can't. And in the end, I think the enormous grief that I felt at my father's death is what tore my romantic relationship apart. And it's certainly, death is such an exposure. It's such a personal apocalypse. And I love that apocalypse, it means revelation, you know, to reveal things as they really are. There's no hiding. When you're in deep grief, I guess you can hide or you can refuse to grieve. Those are definitely choices. But if you decide to go into it, then there is this way in which your sense of self becomes so dissolved in the profound grief that what you're left with is this very small piece of, I wouldn't even say persona. I mean, I would say a year on from my son's death, I have no idea who I am. And I think that's probably likely to last a lifetime. I mean, it undercuts any false sense of security one may have or any sense of a life that you've built or imagined for yourself going forward. Any container that you have is smashed and you realize, oh, well, I mean, this is who I always was. I just had all this veneer around me of believing that it wouldn't happen to me or believing that it wouldn't happen in the States or believing that I'd already suffered enough or believing that I'd known enough or believing that you're evolved enough or believing that your children are secure enough or believing that the country's all the, you know, I mean, it's all just a form of insecurity, these kind of beliefs that one has. I think that the thing that came to me through the grief was an emotional, grief like that makes of you an emotional miser. You don't have, one does not any longer have the extensive emotional, you know, bandwidth, I think, to stay in relationships that are toxic. I'm not saying that my mother's toxic or that my sister's toxic or that I'm toxic even, but the relationship when the three of us interact certainly was immediately toxic. I think what one realizes, I realized, perhaps they realized this too, that to be who I am, I would have had to kill in order to be who they needed me to be in the remaining family structure. And I'd already lost too much to lose that last essence of myself. And I think when you've gone through a grief like this, it'll do one of two things to you. You'll either go through that year or two. You know, I called it 9 months on the cross. Honestly, it felt after my son died as if, you know, you're God-forsaken, as if you're misunderstood, as if no, and no one can carry the grief for you. The cavalry isn't coming. This is you. This is your grief. This is your responsibility, and it's yours to do well. But having done that so alone, and my mother and sister unable to sort of come to me because they were still in the crisis of my father's death, I think that cemented a kind of ending to our material relationship that I would be surprised if it sort of resurged in this lifetime. But I've been so surprised by this lifetime that I don't say it will or won't. I do know that all I can do is sit in my silence, sit in my unknowing, sit in my mystery, sit in my understanding that the instruction is to love and see what comes of it. But you also can't go repeatedly uninvited or unwanted back into relationships. The relationship with my fiance actually has rekindled. And that, in a weird sort of way, 9 months after my son died, we reconnected. And it felt to me as if our relationship sort of passionate. He's an artist. I'm a writer. There's so much creativity. There's so much tension and battling over creative space. It never would have survived the death of my son. And so in a way, it felt like a reward at the end of a grief properly done to have a restful place to love. I wouldn't say a chance to love again or any of those things. I don't even believe in that now. I think that the only person you can truly love or any, is yourself. And if you do it with enough integrity, you will, in the love of yourself, love God and your children and the whole world and your enemy and everyone. And that is ultimately the goal.
Now, it's only been 13 months, you know, since you lost your son, which is a blink, you know, in terms of a time frame. But you write just so incredibly about your experience. It's primal. It's animalistic. It's the wail that comes from the center of your soul because of what you've lost. At what point can you get up and go, okay, I can make a cup of coffee, I can bring my kids to school, and I can take care of some tasks today, and then tomorrow maybe I can do that again?
Both of my daughters, who were in deep, deep, deep grief after my son died, began to write before I did. And when they wrote, my oldest daughter started a blog on her grief, and my younger daughter started to write fiction. She's 13, my older daughter's 26. And watching that, watching what it meant to even hold an instrument of writing again, made me realize that I needed to do, I needed to be the example of how to get through this. Because we don't have very many examples in this culture of what resilience actually looks like. In white settler culture, even our sort of religious institutions are quite anemic when it comes to, here's how you become resilient. Here's how you put down your weaponized fragility. Here's how not to be in a state of crumbling, you know, self-indulgent grief for the rest of your life. So a month and a day after my son died, I sat back down at my computer. But a week after he died, I knew I would not survive unless I got myself into the mountains. And so both of those things, probably 2 weeks after he died, I dragged myself, a friend actually, dragged me into the mountains, and we set up camp, and I began the rituals that I needed to start doing. Sitting in front of water, having a relationship with the wild, which I think people in the West can really relate to, that the loneliness of the death of a child is so profound. The only relief isn't people, it's the whole universe. I mean, I needed to lie under the stars. I needed to watch the passage of the moon. I needed to be by a fire. Suddenly the elements were what kept me going, because I understood that Fuller, my son, was in all the elements. He was in the fire. He was in the stars. He was in the universe. He was in the water next to where I was camping. I dragged my sheep wagon into the mountains and began to write. And, you know, your sort of biological self is completely disrupted by grief. And so there's no sleep. You can't eat. You don't, the normal things that you do to sort of keep yourself going become chores. And in that restlessness finding, you know, you have to find whatever God is for you, your God, or you won't make it. I mean, maybe your body will, maybe you will get through till the end of your own end of life, but you won't have lived.
At the end of the book, you bring it back to, well, you don't bring it back, but you mention again the immigrants that you came across and the refugees and the mass exodus of humanity that was the backdrop to your father dying in Budapest. And you know, you've talked earlier about, you know, this grief that we have of humanity. And, you know, I often think when we're seeing what's going on now at the southern border here, what's happening in Europe and this massive exodus and movement of humanity, and the suffering that people go through, it's unimaginable. And yet we don't take the time to really imagine it, because I think that would just break open ourselves. And then we would have to do something about it.
That's it. That's it. And so I think two things have happened out of this terrible grief, which I wouldn't wish on anyone, because it's not fun. But I now know what I would say to someone who had lost a child, which is, you're not alone. You're going to feel terribly alone, but you're not alone. And if you stay in this dark long enough, almost unimaginably, there will be light. And in that light comes your instruction. And I think this is true of everyone who has done deep grief. The instruction is not to get caught and paralyzed in, I mean, the cycles of grief occur. I mean, maybe it's just because I've gone through so many that I sort of, it's almost got to the point where I look at someone and I go, well, they're just in denial, or they seem really stuck in anger, or, ah, that's bargaining, or, oh boy, depression. Or you meet someone who may have gone through the most incredible suffering, and yet they have a buoyancy and a generosity of spirit and a possession, a self-possession. And you know, that person has reached acceptance. And I think that as we have to imagine other people's grief and sorrow. I mean, it's your human duty. But you can't do it unless you've done your own grief. It's that instruction from the Bible, take the twig out of your own eye before you wrestle with your neighbor's plank. Because doing that, you will, I think, do the work that makes the work you need to do natural and easy and not forced and not create more inflammation. I mean, old Alexandra Fuller would have loved to have raced to the border and sort of got into the suffering somehow and thought that reporting about it perhaps would have changed things. I mean, I think I've done enough of that kind of work. New Alexandra Fuller isn't so sure what to do, but I'm fairly sure that if I'm faced with a situation of suffering, I will know what to do in that moment, but I don't have prescriptions anymore. And I think that that's new.
But, you know, I've been thinking, is the amount of grief and suffering people have gone through when they arrive at the southern border. And yes, it's unconscionable that we add to it. It's yes, like unbelievable. It's like, yeah, you know what these people have gone through just to get to our door.
I think that there is this, I mean, again, this is something that I have hammered to death, and I have often wondered what an extraordinary biography I got to have been born into self-avowed, very proud white supremacist nation. I mean, they didn't call themselves white supremacists. They didn't have to, just the way Americans don't have to call them. I mean, if you are it, you don't have to say it. But, you know, looking back, I've insisted on calling it white supremacy, not just racism, white racism, not just racism, because it seems important to sort of own where the genesis of this pain is coming from. But an unconsciousness about the pain that has been caused by your lifestyle is critical to sustaining white supremacy and white privilege. It's a desire to do nothing about it, or to squat, or to taunt or arrest people who are doing something about it, is very natural. I mean, I see so many similarities between Rhodesia circa 1977 and the United States of America circa 2019. The othering, the increasingly overt, almost sort of buoyant racism. I mean, this way in which it's become really okay to be overtly racist, really okay to be overtly cruel to people who are differently abled. You know, this kind of, we're really, I think, at an axis breaking point here. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with a refusal to grieve our own griefs, our own smallness, our own mediocrity, our own terror, our own fear, our own neurosis. And so I absolutely agree with Arsene that by the time people have arrived at the southern border, they've already gone through so much suffering, to add to it is unconscionable. But we're adding to it because we haven't done our own work. Had we done our own work, we would be available.
And what reminds me of Rhodesia, you know, late 1970s or South Africa or any of these apartheid states, and what's happening now is in the US around white supremacy, is the fact that individuals say, well, I'm not racist.
That's
but
right.
Then have such an acute lack of awareness of their role
right.
in the bigger structures
right.
that are supporting white supremacy.
Well, one of the things that I've started to say is, look, most white people in the United States of America did not own slavery, but the whole system supported slavery, and it would have taken every white person to object to slavery. I mean, your silence is collusion. And I think that that has become probably my, in a way, my biggest work is to refuse silence and to refuse collusion and to refuse the comfort of this dominant narrative that everything's sort of going to wash itself out, or that migrants have sort of accidentally washed up at our border, that there's no bigger, broader story about, you know, our actions involved in that.
You know, my wife went to a school in Washington, D.C. called Georgetown Visitation. It was a girls' school, Catholic. And it was recently revealed, like the last 2 years, that they had slaves. And the story had been that the nuns had taught the slaves to read. So they brought in a historian. And it was discovered that not only did they not teach the slaves to read, that they sold the slaves to continue financing the institution, and that they were willing to break up a family. Like, we can't take care of the mother, we'll just sell the kids or whatever. And so the whole, this happened in 1820, you know, and so this has been going on, you know, 200 years later, that institution might not have existed if it wasn't on the backs of slavery. And so it doesn't mean everybody, whoever went there, is racist or anything like that. But look at the structures that we have in place.
I mean, look, yes. Where we're sitting on stolen land. You know,
yes.
As we are, and yet so many people bring it to an individual level to say, well, I'm not directly participating in this.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of seeing their role in just the greater structure
right.
of it all.
Since this is the water that I swim in, I couldn't help. And, you know, it goes back to Arsene's earlier question, do you see everything as a writer? I don't even know so much as I see everything as a writer as I see everything as myself. And I am a writer, and being a writer is inseparable from that. But I do filter everything through the experience of growing up in white supremacy and white privilege and having to deconstruct my own racism, conscious and unconscious. Because the truth is, most white Americans are brought up with a great deal of racism, but since it's they're on the oppressing side. It's very hard to feel it. But they will go, oh, yes, my uncle, you know, we have these uncomfortable Thanksgiving dinners, at which no one's challenged. And so the structure, the injustice continues. And yet, as an individual, we think we have no role to play in that, when we have an enormous role. That said, it's very skillful work to challenge and change someone's prejudice, but prejudice comes out of a great deal of fear. So the quickest way to cut off the conversation is to increase the fear. Now you just have very fearful, now you have to have a whole table full of fearful people and a fight brewing. And that doesn't bring, you know, ultimately this very difficult thing that I think we're being asked to do as humanities, which is love our perceived enemy. That was a basic construction. It is very difficult to do. Love your enemy? That's rigorous.
Alexandra Fuller, thank you so much for coming in and for your writing, being so incredibly honest, not just in your books, but also right here in person too. Thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me back.
The Radio Book Club is a collaboration between KG and you and the Boulder Bookstore. This was a very special edition that we had to have Alexandra in. This is the week her new memoir comes out, Travel Light, Move Fast. And of course, you can catch the Radio Book Club normally on the fourth Thursday of every month. And of course, subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Arson, thanks very much.
Thank you, Maeve.